Good Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a pretty good start so far. Coming up to 10:06. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Well, get ready for another edition of Science Files this morning. St. Mary's astrophysicist Rob Thacker is settling in for the hour, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, we're going to the phones to hear what's on your mind this morning. Manic Monday is coming up next hour, our first open hour of the week, and of course, as always, anything goes. After the news at noon, we'll talk about drinking and driving with MAD's Atlantic Director, Anissa McLeod, as MAD gets ready to kick off its annual Red Ribbon campaign. We'll also hear her reaction to the two-year sentence imposed last week on the drunk driver who struck and killed Ray Hart downtown last year. And we'll hear another Halifax history moment when historian and author Blair B. joins me this afternoon. 10:06 right now, this hour, it's time for Science Files. And joining me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
And how are you this fine Monday morning?
I'm still trying to kick that virus. My wife was really sick over the weekend, and she's like coughing. She has a little bit of asthma, so sometimes cough turns into asthma. And I was sort of like being sympathetic, helping out, keeping her better and so on, or helping her get better. But no, I'm still not quite out of the woods yet.
That's going around. Steve Stretch is in here the last hour battling something.
Yeah.
Got some co-workers who've been off.
It's that time of the year.
Yeah. 1-877-902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255 if you've got a question or a comment for Dr. Rob. And let me just first say, Dr. Rob, please open your mind. I used to tell Zarowski this all the time. He used to absolutely drive him wild because he knew something was coming. It was totally outlandish.
My feet are twitching. My eyelids are going. Yeah.
The question is time travel possible?
Yes, but not what you're thinking.
Oh, okay. Well, I mention this because of this Greta Thunberg, the young climate change activist who's right now gallivanting around the world, warning us about...
Well, she's hardly gallivanting. Well, she's moving very slowly, in fact.
She's on a boat right now across the ocean back to Europe. But she's warning us about the climate crisis and why there's immediate need to deal with something along
absolutely.
Those lines.
Important message.
There was a photo from the 1890s, the Yukon Gold Rush, that shows a young girl at a well with a remarkable resemblance. In fact, they're identical to what Greta Thunberg looks like today. And it's led to all kinds of social media theories here now. Granted, social media, mind you, so you know that, you know, the source, of course. But suggesting that maybe she's a time traveler. Now, didn't Einstein say that the possibility existed, the time travel?
Are we actually doing this on air?
Yes, we are.
Seriously?
Yes.
No, I mean, come on. What's the probability that 100 years apart, two individuals could look similar? Ooh. Crazy. No, she must be a time traveler. No, I mean, okay, it's fun. And I have to admit, there is an uncanny resemblance between the two of them.
Even the braids are the same.
Right. Well, you know, it's just a picture, but come on, for heaven's sake, it's just a picture. So... is Greta a time? It's a movie plot right there.
There you go.
Right, it's a movie plot. But someone make that movie.
Einstein's theory of relativity did kind of open the door to that.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about the technical side of it. And so you're right. There is something called closed time-like curves in general relativity, and that allows the time coordinate to loop around, which is interesting. Right. But it creates additional paradoxes by doing that. And so the example of the paradox that it creates is, so I have a watch that was given to me by my grandmother, let's say. Yep. And then I get on that time loop and go back in time, give the watch to my grandmother and say, give it to me. Right. And she does it. And then we keep on going round and round. Where was the watch created?
Oh, you're throwing kind of monkey wrench into my thoughts here.
Right. And that's the paradox, right? Because you have a watch, but it's never been created anywhere within that time loop. And so it is as problematic as just sort of like zipping back in time and so on. So, yeah, even though supposedly there are geometries in general relativity, that allow closed time-like curves, they introduce all sorts of paradoxes, especially in relation to things like the second law of thermodynamics, which says that things get continually more disordered, although that does... There are some technicalities there. Specifically, it applies to closed systems, but this would arguably be an open system where you can share energy and things like that. So, Greta's not a time Well, she's a time traveler in terms of going into the future, because we're all time travelers in that sense. And that was what I was trying to say, because we're all time traveling into the future all the time.
But I mean, there's you've talked about different dimensions as well. I mean, is that a possibility?
Yeah, so this is just okay. So there is a theory that in quantum mechanics, what happens when you make a measurement and you force an atomic system to choose a particular state, all the different states are actually out there, and there are an infinite number of different universes, right? And so just when you make a measurement, use it from one universe to another one, and so on and so forth. And so the idea that some people have suggested is, well, you know, maybe in time travel, if we had these sort of like closed time-like curves, maybe one of those curves would start in one universe and go to a different universe. And it sounds cool. It sounds like the plot. Well, it's actually
science fiction.
Has been used in science fiction TV shows, for that matter. Mm. But the reality is, we know of no way to keep these so-called time loops or closed time-like curves open and stable. So, no.
Yeah. Too bad.
I know it's fun, and it's a Monday morning, so should we start with something fun? Woo-hoo.
No. One of the latest theories, by the way, on Greta now is that she came from the future. This was a photo, perhaps not so much of the Yukon Gold Rush in 1890s, but a photo from what the future holds for us if we don't do something now about climate crisis.
But wouldn't she have been grown up in the future? So it will be a picture of older Greta back in the past.
You're starting to talk sense here, darling. Enough foolishness. Greta Thunberg is not a time traveler.
Oh, no, there's not a hole in a time travel paradox argument. Oh, who would have thought?
But still, that photo, I mean, it's... You're right.
It is uncanny. It's uncanny resemblance. I happily admit that. But I mean, there are uncanny resemblances all the time. We all know that. We go to a different city and you're walking in the train station, you see someone who looks like a friend. It happens.
Yeah. I've had people say to me, I saw you in Saskatchewan the other day. And I said, what are you talking about? They were at some conference in Saskatchewan. Yeah. This was a political thing. And I think it was the mayor of the day here came back and said, we saw your doppelganger in Saskatchewan.
There you go.
It's amazing.
There you go.
Yeah. Stephen's on the line. He's going to change the subject here for us this morning. Hi, Stephen.
Hi there.
How you doing today?
Excellent.
Good. You have a question for Dr. Rob.
Yes. I'm just wondering, this proposed SpaceLink satellite project by
Starlink.
How is that going to affect Starlink? Yes. Yeah. How is that going to affect viewing the night sky? If there's, potentially between whatever, I think it's 5 to 10,000 satellites or something like that for broadband.
Well, tell us what Starlink is first.
Right. So Starlink is a proposed network. Well, it's actually not proposed. There have been two launches for it. Yeah. So it's going to be a network of or constellation of satellites, as they call them, all around the world. Several thousand of them. The precise number is not determined right now, although in theory they have a license for up to 40,000 of these things. Right. And so the concerns have already been voiced in the astronomical community that around twilight, when the angle of the sun is such that it will actually capture, it will bounce off these satellites and back down to the surface of the Earth really quite strongly, then literally these things will probably light up around the edges of the horizon and so on. And you'll see these things actually at that time of night. You can see them fairly high.
So
as
no
well.
More nighttime sky stargazing?
Well, so this is the thing. Now, when this first started happening, I did contact a few of my colleagues about 2 years ago and said, is this going to be a problem? And they said, well, at twilight, definitely. Right, because the angle is such that it's going to be an issue, and there's always going to be. I think it was 8 or 9 of these things potentially visible during twilight time, someone was saying. But that depends upon the number of satellites. And so it definitely will have an impact at twilight. Now, once you get into the deep night, when you're rotated all the way around, then all of those satellites that are, especially the ones that are kind of overhead, those are largely in the shadow of the Earth, so they're not too much of a problem. Mm. But you're absolutely right. And we've seen some of these pictures already from I think it was a telescope in Chile that was taken just around 90 minutes before the sun came up, and there was a huge series of streaks from the recently launched Starlinks across it. But those will change and disperse over time, so that was kind of optimally bad. But nonetheless, yes, it's going to be an issue.
Wow. And this satellite link, as you call it, that's for internet, right? I believe that that's
yeah,
to provide
it's for global
fast,
internet. Yeah. And I mean, and the arguments you're seeing on social are basically like, well, you know, astronomy, yeah, that's great, but isn't internet more important to people around the globe? And I'm like, well, yeah, I get that, but there are many different ways of providing the internet. And in this particular case, it's likely that this is going to be an internet service for people who are fairly well off, to be honest, because it's not going to be cheap in all likelihood.
So, Steve, this is a concern for you?
Not really. I'm curious. You know, sometimes you can view the space station of when it's passing over. So I wonder if it was just going to like light up the sky. You'd have all these small satellites.
Yeah, there will definitely be some that are quite visible. Yeah. So the one thing they can do that they haven't done is they can actually put blackness over the satellites. They did this for the second generation of Iridium satellites, so they didn't flare as much as the first generation did. So there are things that they can do.
Right.
All right. Appreciate the call, Steve. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. 10:15, coming up to 10:16 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University is with us for another edition of Science Files. And if you've got a comment or a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also reach us via email. My email address, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a comment or Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. We'll be back with more with Dr. Rob right after this quick break. 10:19, Dr. Rob Thacker with me here on a Monday morning, and Frank has emailed a question and wondering if you would, Dr. Rob, explain a quantum leap.
So the Quantum Leap is a good TV series that was a lot of fun 25 years
that
ago.
That was a while
so,
back, yeah.
So Scott Bakula, wasn't it?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, but the term Quantum Leap, scientifically, I don't think, I could be wrong, but I don't think scientifically it has a specific meaning, but it does have a meaning as a phrase that we use in our language a lot of the time, and that's a sudden improvement, a sudden jump that's not a sort of like small improvement. It's a really big change, and so for that, people use the term quantum leap.
What are you showing me here?
Right, so I found, I'm going to try and treat it. I found online the picture I was talking about from Ciro Tolo of this image that was taken. It's about a 3-degree piece of the night sky, and it's literally covered with all of these tracks.
All the satellites, yeah, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And again,
so I'll retweet it on my feed.
Just now, people are beginning to, you know, wake up to the possibilities here that the impact these could have.
Yeah. I'm kind of frustrated because it's not like we haven't known this is coming.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's a little bit frustrating for me because I did engage with a number of colleagues about this 2 years ago once I heard this was happening. And people were like, well, you know, deep in the nighttime when we're far turned around from the sun, they won't be a problem. But nonetheless, we try and do as much astronomy as we can, including in that period of twilight as well. And if we can't, if we lose that basically completely, it's going to be a bit of a problem.
But you did say they could darken or blacken these
satellites. Yeah, they can do that. Yeah. So this is something that you can do with satellites. You have to sort of manage the heat on them properly because that black will actually absorb heat a little bit. But this has been done on a number of different satellites.
Hmm, interesting. Bob's given us a call here this morning with a question. Morning, Bob.
Morning, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm well, sir. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you very much. Dr. Rob. That Greta girl, she's really making us all aware of climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. If you're living under a rock, you probably don't know that it's happening. But my question is about tectonic plate activity on the Earth right now.
Okay, I'll do my best.
You're an astrophysicist, right?
That's right. Yep.
So tectonics is not your specialty?
It's not. I'm not a geologist, no, or a geographer for that matter. But like I said, I can try and help.
Fire the question.
Well, there are a lot of, they're calling them swarm earthquakes over in the West Coast right now in the Caucasian subduction zone. And this thing is supposed to go off. And Rick had a caller earlier this morning about tsunamis.
Yep.
Yes, that's correct.
Yep.
I was just wondering, the continental shelf here on the east coast of North America, would that be affected if there was some kind of catastrophic event on the West Coast? How structurally sound is that? Could there be a landslide on the continental shelf causing a tsunami?
All right. Appreciate the call, Bob, and let's see what Dr. Rob can say.
Well, you know, I don't honestly know. I mean, I suspect with one of the things with major activity in earthquakes is you can trigger things off that are nearby, right? But how far across the Earth does an earthquake or how big does an earthquake have to be to actually have an impact across on the other side of a continent? I'm not sure, and I would guess that it has to be really, really serious to have any significant effect. And in terms of triggering something that would produce a massive tsunami off the continental shelf here, my guess would be that would actually have to be absolutely huge, right? Because at least on very long distances, once you start taking into account how energy is spread out, then it's not going to be localized on the particular continental shelf all that distance away. It's going to spread out around the Earth. But I don't know for sure, and I'm not going to claim that I know, but my guess would be it would have to be absolutely enormous to have any kind of chain reaction like this.
Well, there was a recent report about why Nova Scotia could be in the path of a future tsunami. And it says here, just let me read from it. It says the lower part of the Scotian slope, located south of Nova Scotia, experiences massive underwater landslides at a rate 10 times higher than initially believed, according to this recent study published in Geology. They're happening about once every 1,000 years instead of once every 10,000 years.
Okay.
And of course,
I
back in the early...
I can see why the caller is concerned.
Yeah, so, in the early 20s, there was a tsunami that hit the southern part of Newfoundland and killed a number of people.
So the thing that I've heard in relation to tsunamis hitting the eastern seaboard is the western side of the Canary Islands, one of the Canaries, is unstable. And that would release a huge millions and millions of tons of rock. And that would produce a massive tsunami. But I hadn't heard about this particular situation. So, yeah, I mean, that just goes to tell you how little we know about what happens to the surface, or sorry, the bottom of the ocean, I should say, not the surface of the ocean, right? And all of that subsurface geology is something that we really don't have all that much information on. So this is fascinating stuff to learn and important stuff to learn about, for that matter.
Yeah, 1929, they call it the Grand Banks earthquake.
Interesting.
Led to the death of 28
well,
people.
Well, I'm learning something this morning. Yeah. That's cool.
10:25 is the time, and Ken's on the line with a question here this morning. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Rob and Rick. A question and comment. One, the Russians, for the past few years, have been working on this hypersonic, nuclear-powered, low-level cruise missile rocket. So have the Chinese, and the Americans are trying to catch up. I'd like to know, how would it work, having a nuclear reactor on a rocket? And the comment, number two, the Flat Earth Society had their big convention last weekend. The defrocked priest, who was one of the leaders, was on the media. What does Rob think of the Flat Earth Convention? There were 600 to 1,000 people in California, and they say they're growing.
Yeah, 600
anyway,
to 1,000.
Comments off the air.
Lost souls. All right, thanks, Ken.
Okay, so my understanding with the hypersonic missiles was they were actually ramjets, right?
Okay.
So ramjets are basically a form of a jet engine, but they don't have the compressor that a regular jet engine has. They basically use the speed to actually compress the air and then exhaust it out the back after it's combusted. So So there have been nuclear-powered rockets. That is a concept. There are many different ways of making a nuclear-powered rocket, from just using the heat of the reactor to actually using nuclear reactions themselves. But I don't think that's actually the propulsion system. I think it's either the delivery system or whatever. And the flat earthers, well, there are flat earthers all around the globe. So,
right up there with time travelers.
Yeah, so the thing to remember is flat earth originally started out as basically an after-dinner debating society. And let's practice how we can sort of like debate whether the earth is flat or round and try and come up with as many wrong arguments as we can. And so it's kind of taken off as this thing to be contrarian. I mean, nowadays... It's almost like being sort of like different is seen as an important thing to be. So people want to disagree that the earth is round, even though there's unequivocal evidence that it is round and spherical, I should say. So anyway, yeah, people just want to be different for the sake of being different.
But the problem with this is that there are very highly intelligent people who believe in this or who are.
But they're not. Most of the people, when you pin them down, they don't really believe it. They're just having fun with it.
Yeah, maybe so. Hopefully that's the case. Right. You know, some of the basketball players, for example, that have come out in public and said, yeah, we believe in them.
No, I still think it's people just being a little bit mischievous, a little bit want to wind people up a little bit. And it's a good way to wind up people on the basketball courts.
So. No question. 10:28 is the time right now. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Numbers you could call if you've got a question or a comment. For Dr. Rob here this morning, he's with us till 11 o'clock with another edition of Science Files. But right now, we have to take a quick break for a news update. Stay with us. We'll be back right after the news, and the news is coming up next. 10:32 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker is with us with another edition of Science Files. And if you've got a comment or a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. And Dr. Rob, you've taken all the fun out of my time traveling aspect here. How about this? Yet another claim that someone has seen life on Mars.
Okay.
This is an entomologist.
This is from
now.
Looking at images from the surface. Yeah.
A bug expert says that he is he's trained to see bugs everywhere, and he says he sees bugs on Mars. Is that possible?
No.
No?
No. I mean, there are a number of reasons why I think life on the surface of Mars is really hard, not least of which is the atmosphere. But second of all is the fact that it's constantly bombarded with cosmic rays.
But we know that cockroaches, for example, could survive a nuclear impact, could they not? Or live in a nuclear afterlife?
So cockroaches actually have very resistant DNA, right? And so they don't tend to mutate at the same rates or suffer as significant a damage from radiation as other creatures do, right? So it's true that they would tend to survive longer in a nuclear winter scenario.
Yeah. It says here, unfortunately.
But they don't have a lot of defenses for the cold.
Says Mars is an incredibly hostile environment where even the toughest life forms would have trouble surviving. The temperature and pressure are too low for liquid water to exist. And without an ozone layer, ultraviolet light from the sun penetrates right through the thin atmosphere. So anything crawling around would have to be incredibly hardy.
It's not just UV. It's cosmic rays as well. So it doesn't have a strong enough magnetic field to provide the shielding that we have here. And so it's literally down to around 9 or 10 inches, the whole Martian surface is completely irradiated with cosmic rays. Mm.
But the story ends by saying that is not to say there couldn't be life on Mars. It could be underground in deep caves, under the ice caps, or embedded in permafrost.
Right. Well, but I've said that as well. And so that is the underlying theory, that if there was, at one point in the past, life on the surface, when there was an atmosphere and there was some kind of geodynamo creating a magnetic field, then maybe, just maybe, it could have gone underground somewhere and is still surviving there. But, you know, the only way you're going to know that is to go and look.
Yeah. What about fossils? Would they be fossil evidence of fossils?
Yes.
Perhaps?
And thus far, we've not found anything convincing at all.
Hmm.
Right. But to be completely fair, you think about how difficult it is to find fossils on the Earth, right? And then take that and apply that to another planet.
Yeah, so, especially a planet right now that's only being explored by rovers. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The only planet in the solar system totally inhabited by robots.
That's right. For now.
Not robots, robots.
For now, right? I mean, with all AI and all of this, Matt, good morning.
How's it going?
Going well, Matt.
Good,
how about
thanks.
Yourself?
Oh, not too bad. I'm going to change the subject again.
Okay, go ahead.
Sounds good.
I'd like to ask Robert there, have you ever heard of geoengineering?
I have a little bit, yep.
And can you explain to the people what exactly the process is of that and why they're doing it?
Okay, so geoengineering is the concept of basically engineering the whole Earth. And so where this would be the primary example is climate change. And so the concept of instead of, planting more trees, you could come up with some way of absorbing CO2 into the oceans using something that you put in the water or something like that is an example. And so geoengineering is something that we can understand because we're very good at building things, but it's engineering on an absolutely colossal scale to change the nature of the whole Earth.
This was something they talked about perhaps in Mars, for example.
No, that's completely analogous. So to make Mars even remotely inhabitable on the surface level, you would have to do an enormous geoengineering project to do that. And it's a colossal amount of energy and engineering.
So your concern about this, Matt, is what? Or your question is why?
Well, they're doing geoengineering right on our planet here. They're spraying our skies with heavy metal particulates to block out the UV rays to lower the temperature.
And are they doing that, Dr. Rob?
Not as far as I'm aware. That's contrails in the air from jet aircraft, not chemtrails.
I highly disagree because a contrail doesn't lay in the sky and then expand and haze over the sky.
Yes, it does.
And I know for a fact
that... Okay, Rick, you're cool on this one.
Thanks, Matt. Matt, you've been debunked. Let's go to Wayne next year this morning. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning. Two questions, really. One is about the stall speed of aircraft. As I understand it, when a plane is flying, the engines are pushing it fast enough forward that it pushes wind underneath and gives lift to the aircraft. Mm-hmm. When it's landing, therefore, it slows down quite a bit. And I'm guessing at one point it has to get less than stall speed in order to get on the ground. why doesn't it fall down then when that happens? Is it because of the edges of the wing that they lower, which may act as a brake and increase that air pressure so they can fly at slower speed?
There's another thing as well that comes into account. So the first thing you're doing is you're putting the flaps out to give you more surface area on the wing, right, to provide additional lift. But the second thing that happens is as the plane comes down closer to the ground, you get literally what's called the ground effect. And that tries and literally sort of acts as a buffer, trying to keep the plane up a little bit. And so you actually have to go through that as you come down. Anyone who's been on a flight simulator, you may have actually felt this. As you come down, you flare up a little bit, and then you feel both the combination of the increased lift from flaring and then the ground effect try and keep you up a little bit. And then you're right. As you come down, you do go eventually through that situation of going under the stall speed.
Well, that buffer then is it's creating enough pressure underneath the plane to let it come gently down.
It's a little bit like that. Yep, sure.
Yeah. All right. The next one is about an author named Pyle. I've had a book recommended to me. And he writes about all the weird space missions that were tried, were never tried, were thrown in the dustbin and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of this author?
No, I haven't off the top of my head, but that doesn't necessarily
P-Y-L-E.
Mean...
P-Y-L-E. Well, he talks about Russian and American. It covers the whole thing.
Okay.
So maybe I'll just proceed and get that book.
All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call, Wayne. Thanks very much. You haven't heard of this.
It doesn't necessarily mean someone isn't writing interesting books I haven't heard of them, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Alan is next. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, folks. Dr. Rob, enjoy you every time you're on the air. And I must confess, I missed the last couple of weeks. And so you and Rick may have covered this because just a few weeks ago, I was very disappointed. I was sitting down listening to my television here, and I'm in my mid-60s. And back in the day when my science and social studies class, I could rip off the nine planets and was so proud that Pluto was one of them. And, as you know, sir, it's been an ongoing thing over the many years. But back here a couple of weeks ago, there was a couple of scientists that, revived it again, saying, absolutely not, Pluto is not a planet. I'm just wondering what's your feeling on this, sir, and what's the deal here?
Well,
anyway?
I'm going to have to let you down, I'm afraid, because I'm one of those horrible people who thinks Pluto isn't officially a planet as we understand.
Right?
And that's because it's too small? Or?
Yeah, it's basically too small. It doesn't have an impact on the area around it the same way we think or the way we describe planets as having. So it doesn't clear its orbit is one of the main things about it. If things go close enough to it, then yes, they could be sort of like shifted out of the way, but it doesn't clear it at the same level as a regular planet does. And so that's one of the reasons why. I mean, but that doesn't make Pluto any less interesting or any less amazing, because it is totally amazing. The surface is absolutely fascinating.
But they'll have to revise the whole school science.
It's already done. It's already done.
You and I are disappointed, old timers.
Yeah.
We can rip those off, Rick.
I know. Yeah. You'll have to go back to school.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm a fully paid up member of the International Astronomical Union.
And one other thing, Doctor, that seems lately, you can explain in layman's terms because I've looked at it on the internet and I can't really get a good beat on it, but there are a lot of things now coming, the rise of what they call the exoplanets. Now, what is an exoplanet?
An exoplanet is literally a planet around a star other than the sun. So you can go out and look at the night sky, look at all the different stars that we can see, and then you can monitor them and see if planets go in front of them.
So this is any planet outside the eight that we have within our solar system.
Absolutely,
Okay.
Rick said eight, by the way. There you go.
I've learned my lesson.
I guess if we say Pluto now, we have to refer to the cartoon dog, I guess, Rick.
Thanks, Alex.
All right, Doctor. Thank you very much.
No problem. You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
10:41 is the time. Christopher emails to say, would you mind asking Dr. Thacker about quantum computing? I've read a number of articles, he writes, and many compare it to the space race, and that the first country to achieve it will have the upper hand with regards to national intelligence and security. What is it, he says? What does it mean?
Right.
It's from Chris here this morning.
So that's a good question, because there is a lot of stuff said about quantum computing that tends to go into science fiction a little bit. But quantum computing is a different form of computing from the thing that we do regularly on a calculator or on your phone, the same kind of computing that's happening on your phone all the time. And so what quantum computers do that's different is they allow different possibilities all to be calculated at the same time, which in theory gives them enormous power. But the practical difficulty of quantum computers is they're not what we would call generally programmable, right? It's very difficult to take an algorithm from a digital computer and then run it in such a way on a quantum computer just like that. They don't work that way. You literally build quantum computers to do a specific problem. Now, there's one very specific problem, and this is the thing that is why national security is an issue, and that is cryptography. And cryptography involves basically using numbers to encode things that it just requires so many calculations to figure out how the encoding was done that it's basically impossible to crack that code.
So long, I mean, well past the Enigma machine, for example.
Yeah. Well past Enigma machine type codes. So the idea of a quantum computer is, well, it doesn't really care how many possibilities there are, because if you can build the quantum computer big enough, then you can actually allow it to do the calculations that will do what's called prime number factorization problems. And if you could do that, right, then you would have a code-cracking computer for the modern age. And so there's a lot of interest in it. The algorithms that it takes are fairly well understood, but the process to build computers that do that, or quantum computers that do that, it's tricky. It's not easy to do. And so it's taking a long time. There's all sorts of things related to quantum systems wanting to kind of break down over time. And so people are actively working on that, things called quantum error correction. And so it's a very difficult field. Where it will probably have the biggest payoff is in simulating quantum systems. So simulating groups of atoms, trying to understand the nature of groups of atoms together. That it's absolutely going to be brilliant for, and probably where it will find its biggest application, other than if they do get all of these security things figured out. But that's probably a ways off.
Anyone further ahead than others in regards to this, the U.S., for example?
It's very difficult to know, because a lot of this is happening behind the scenes in private enterprise now. It isn't all happening in the public domain being sort of like government-sponsored research. So it's difficult to know. Certainly, there are a number of basically private companies like Google. There's also a company in Canada as well. So I can't really give you a good answer on that. I'm sure someone in the field might have a better take on it.
Coming up to 10:45, Paul, stay there. You're next. We've got lines open, too, at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Ken just sent us a question via Twitter, our Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show, or even email us a question, rick.howe@news957.com. We'll take another quick break, and we'll be back to hear more from Dr. Rob right after this. Coming up now to 10:48, and Ken tweets a question. He says he recently heard a scientist on Discovery TV state that not only is the Earth warming up, but so are the other planets in our solar system. And he believes it's because as the sun ages, it gets hotter. And he's wondering if there's any validity to that. Yes, no, maybe so.
Well, so let me explain what the general idea is there. And so that's over time, as the sun enters what's called the main sequence, it will actually raise its temperature a bit, which is true.
Yeah.
Right, but that takes a very long period of time. Right?
Billions
We're talking
of years.
Hundreds of millions to billions of years. Yeah. So, excuse me. If you look at what's been happening with the sun's what we call total solar irradiation, or TSI, or total solar irradiance, I should say. So that has been monitored for over 25 years, right? And so we now know that really, it will actually have small variations on the sort of like 1% to 2% level, but these are going up and down all the time. So if you Google TSI, you will see this, and there is no sort of like significant general trend to this other than maybe a tiny trend downwards over those 25 years. There's no significant increase. So in general, no, the sun sort of changing isn't the factor that's making our climate change so much right now. And I know that people really think a lot about this, right? Because you can go and actually look at the internet, you can look at total solar irradiance, and you'll see this, it's posted. People also consider changes in climate models over very long periods as well, when the sun has had a significant change, like over 20,000 of years. And then there are cycles, right, that can have some effect. Right. But in general, for something on the short timescales, we're seeing changes in our atmosphere, then no, the sun is not responsible primarily for that.
But the sun will die, though, what, I think 5 billion years down the road?
Yeah, it will swell up. It will become a red giant. It will swallow the Earth up as well. So, we're going to be toasted.
Yeah. Well, 5 billion years from now, though.
Yeah. Don't lose sleep over
it. No. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys this morning?
We're doing great, Paul. How are you doing this?
Rick, I have to tell you that every Monday morning, I look forward to hearing Dr. Robin and his theories on science. So I really appreciate this show.
Well, not a problem. He's That's here, good. And yeah. he's here to answer yeah. your question there, sure. Paul.
So, Dr. Bob, I hear that you're also a biologist as well. So I have a bird question. Hopefully you can answer it.
So I've published in environmental science. It's not quite, I used to be an ornithologist when I was younger.
Really?
But I used to study birds when I was a kid. But but I haven't done it seriously. I'm always saying what I don't know. So yeah, I'm saying I don't.
All right. So what's your question, Paul?
So the other day I was outside hanging up my Christmas lights. Mm-hmm. And there was, I'm going to call them sparrows. Mm-hmm. There was probably, 200, 300, 400. I don't know how many there were. There was a whack of them. And they attacked this bush, and they made a funny noise as they went out in the bush. And then they all left the bush all at the exact same time. So my question is, what were they doing to the bush? And what signal do they have to leave all at the exact same time?
That's interesting. So there are certainly examples of birds having alarm calls that spook other birds as well and basically make the whole flock fly off. So that's known. In terms of like whether there is a call to make things sort of like swarm on something, that would be new by me. I don't know if any people who work in the area know about that particular kind of behavior. I can certainly imagine that if there was a threat perceived, there may be a tendency for a number of birds to go after that. So, but I don't know. Most of the time when you see something going on, birds tend to sort of like fly away from it rather than flying toward it. So that's a little bit unusual. I'm not really sure, to be honest.
But you've seen the video of the starlings and all flying in unison.
Yeah, but that's a murmur. So those situations are actually related to the overall dynamics of all of the birds flying rather than anyone making a signal saying, hey, everyone, let's go left here. Let's go right. They don't do that. It's all a response to different changes in how the birds are actually moving.
Go ahead, Paul. Sorry.
So what happened after that is they left the bush, and then they went on to the lawn next to me, and then they all landed on the lawn, and they started picking or doing whatever they were doing, looking for worms. I don't know what they're looking for. And then they all took off again, and then attacked another bush. And so that was Saturday. And yesterday, they did the exact same thing to the exact same bush.
Obviously, maybe the bush would be some kind of food source, Dr. Rob, maybe?
I don't know. I mean, I tend to sort of like feel like if they look like they're physically attacking it, then there's probably something that they perceive as a threat within there. But I don't know for sure. Right?
Yeah, I don't know if they were attacking. I know they just all zoomed into the bush and just did what they need to do. They all left at the exact same time.
So I will say that one of the things, so I used to live in Hamilton quite a while ago, and so there was a big bush not far from where we lived, and that was kind of like a huge nesting area for the sparrows. And when you get enough of them together, boy, they make a racket, right? And so if you get a bunch of them that are very active and together, then yeah, they absolutely do make a racket.
Maybe next time Paul gets some video and shares some video with us.
Oh, that would be great,
I went and ran in the hose to get my phone, but they all left at the exact same time.
Hey, he's coming out of the camera, scram!
Yeah. Appreciate the call, Paul. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. It is 10:53 right now. Let's talk about SpaceX Starship prototype blows its top.
Oh, yeah,
some issues here.
This was actually...
This is Musk's group, is it?
Yeah, SpaceX, So Elon Musk. So they tried pressurizing the... So you may recall about, I think it was about a month ago, he stood up outside his Texas manufacturing facility in front of the giant Starship prototype and said, look, we're going to try and fly this 20 kilometers up. Not going to happen now. So purportedly they were filling up the fuel tank to see how structurally strong it was, and it basically collapsed. And so the theory going around that I've seen, I don't know if any more have come out, but certainly last week people were saying that there was a communication problem between the pressuring sensor versus the communications device that would tell them what the pressure was. And so they literally blew it up accidentally. And so all of it was probably liquid nitrogen. That would be the cheapest thing you would fill it up with, just to sort of like put a very cold thing inside and see how it responded to it. But this is a real issue because obviously it's lost all of its structural integrity. They're going to scrap it, and they're going to start using the Mark II version that they have, as well as building a Mark III and Mark IV versions. There's going to be a number of these prototypes. The things that go to orbit, though, are going to be a little bit different from the first two prototypes that they were building, which were basically all stainless steel. The ones that go to orbit, they're going to have the heat tiles. Remember how the space shuttle had the heat tiles?
Yeah.
So the ones that go to orbit are going to have these heat tiles. And they're saying there'll be some modifications made to the particular design of how it comes down. Because they're saying it's literally going to kind of come down like a parachuter comes down, using the fins as a control as it comes down. So it sounds very ambitious to me.
But they've had a number of issues, I guess, mishaps.
Well, to be fair, this engineering is difficult. I have to say, when I look at the amount of effort that NASA takes to get its particular fuel tanks right, because they had an issue with their fuel tanks for the Space Launch System about a year ago, or maybe 18 months ago, this kind of thing is not unexpected. Right, I'm kind of amazed at how SpaceX is building these things out in the open and so on. And a lot of people have been questioning weld integrity and things like that in these systems, because if you see how it fails, it literally blows up in one of the rings, because there was a series of rings to make the Starship. It actually just sort of comes through one of the edges of those rings. So people have been saying, you know, maybe there's a weld issue there. But anyway, so bit of a setback. People are saying, well, you know, maybe 6 months or something like that. So we'll see what happens. Hmm. Musk sort of in his usual way. Oh, did you see the Cybertruck?
Yes, I saw that. And the window that was supposed to be unbreakable.
Like, go on, throw it. Okay, maybe not quite hard.
Try that one.
He's tweeted similar things as a response to this particular
failure.
Back to the
drawing board.
You know, we have another one. We'll use that particular prototype, and then we're really interested in what happens with the Mark III and Mark IV. He's saying, oh, we had already decided we weren't going to fly this one. People were wondering, has this destroyed the engines? As far as we're aware, there were no engines mounted on it when they were doing the test. They were literally just testing the shell and the fuel tanks. And so it's a bit of a setback, but literally not a huge nightmare for them in the big scheme of things.
I think we could squeeze one more question in here this morning. Alexander, if you're quick, you've got a little time here with Dr. Rob.
Oh, God. Hi, gentlemen. I'll make it as quick as I can. It's more of a curious question. I'm just wondering, Dr. Rob, do you know of any research that's been done into the maximum population that this Earth can support?
We're at what are we at now? 8 billion?
Seven
billion? Okay.
I'm off the top of my head, no, but there's certainly an awful lot of stuff being done on overall. The big problem with that kind of research is what assumptions you make about how you can improve the efficiency of farming. Right. And so those are kind of unknowns, because people will immediately resort to like GMO technologies and things like that. So I don't know off the top of my head, but yes, I'm absolutely sure that stuff has been done. I mean, stuff about the actual carrying capacity of the Earth dates back at least to the group of Rome scientists who published the famous treatise in the early 70s.
Okay. There you go, Alexander.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
I appreciate the call. Thank you. And time's up, Dr. Rob. Is always interesting.
That was a bunch of really different questions.
It really was.
It was like a number of things. I was like, you know, I'm really not sure. I'm not going to say too much on that.
Well, we covered a lot of ground here this morning. And as always, I appreciate it. And we'll see you again next Monday.
Absolutely.
Dr. Rob Thacker with us on a Monday morning with Science Files. It is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update. Then it's your turn. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday, and, well, anything goes between 11 and 12, and all you have to do is give us a call. Our phone lines await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, and we'll take your calls after a news update, and it is coming up next.